everybody. We got a great one today. You know, for a change, Scott Galloway is my guest. Scott is an NYU professor of marketing and host of the very popular Prof. G podcast and co-host with Kara Swisher of Pivot, also a very popular podcast. Scott is a great talker, terrific talker. You're going to love this one, you know, for a change. We recorded this a few weeks ago, right after the assassination attempt on former President Trump, and that got Scott talking about lost young men who become isolated, go online, and then can drift into insanity. That took Scott to the gap in generational wealth between baby boomers and young people. Since then, a lot has happened. Vice President Kamala Harris, of course, is now the Democratic nominee for president. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, my governor, is the vice presidential nominee. I picked that one last week. And the presidential race has changed to a statistically even match with less than 90 days to go. This past Thursday, Donald Trump held a press conference where he complained about press coverage of his crowd sizes versus those of the vice president. Can we play that, Peter?
Oh, give me a break. Listen, I had 107,000 people in New Jersey. You didn't report it. I'm so glad you asked. What did she have yesterday, 2,000 people? If I ever had 2,000 people, you'd say my campaign is finished. It's so dishonest, the press. And here's a great example. I had, in Michigan recently, 25,000 people, and 25,000 people, we just couldn't get them in. We had in Harrisburg, 25,000 people, and 20,000 people couldn't get in. We had so many, nobody ever mentions that. When she gets 1,500 people, and I saw it yesterday on ABC, which they said, oh, the crowd was so big. I have 10 times, 20 times, 30 times the crowd size, and no, they never say the crowd was big. That's why I'm always saying, turn around the cameras. I'm so glad you asked that. I think it's so terrible when you say, well, she has 1,500 people, 1,000 people, and they talk about, oh, the enthusiasm. Let me tell you, we have the enthusiasm. The Republican Party, and me as a candidate, but the Republican Party has the enthusiasm. But I think that the people of January 6th were treated very unfairly, and, you know, it's very interesting. The biggest crowd I've ever spoken to, and I said, peacefully and patriotically, which everybody wants to say.
Well, we didn't have a chance to check with those numbers. The Republican vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, has kind of been tailing Vice President Harris. And in Wisconsin, he approached Air Force Two. They were both at the same airport, and he approached Air Force Two with a bunch of his guys saying he wanted to check out what would be his plane in a few months. I'm sure that was just a good-natured kidding around rather than just a dick move. Nah, it was a weird dick move. Anyway, we've got Scott Galloway and a great one, you know, for a change.
I heard you say on Morning Joe that we are producing too many of the most dangerous person in the world. That is a young, broke, and lonely young man.
Well, look, the data's pretty stark. Men are four times as likely to kill themselves as women. They're only 60% as likely to go to college. They're three times as likely to be addicted. They're 12 times as likely to be incarcerated. Look at the most violent societies in the world. They all have one thing in common, and that is too many young men who have a scant economic and mating opportunities.
How much of this is social media?
I think social media creates a lot of loneliness and gives, unfortunately, okay, so we have very, very basic instincts. We have Paleolithic instincts, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And the deepest resource companies run by the most, arguably the most talented people in the world, are giving young men a sense that they can have a reasonable facsimile of life on a screen with an algorithm. So why make the effort to establish friends when you have Discord and Reddit? Why get a job when you can trade stocks or crypto on Robinhood or on Coinbase? And why make the effort of showering, working out, having a plan, enduring rejection, developing a sense of humor, showering for God's sake, such that you can get a girlfriend when you have YouPorn? And what happens over the medium and long term is these men become sequestered from society. They don't have the guardrails of a romantic relationship. I would still be getting high every night if my girlfriend right out in college said, stop getting high every night or I'm no longer going to have sex with you. That was a powerful motivator for me to get my shit together. Romantic relationships, young men need guardrails. They need them more than women. Their prefrontal cortex literally matures later. And without the prospect of a romantic relationship or in-person mentorship or in-person friendship, men come off the rails. And loneliness is no worse for women. But if you look at the data, 2 in 3 women under the age of 30 have a boyfriend, only 1 in 3 men, because women are dating older because they want more economically and emotionally viable men. And so you have this cohort of men who feel rejected by women, have a less professional opportunities if they're not in the slipstream of the information economy. Maybe they're not cut out for college, fewer manufacturing jobs. And they're in their home seeing more and more online content, which quite frankly leads them to conspiracy theory and is run on rage. So these young men become more susceptible to nationalist content, misogynistic content, and some they become shitty citizens. We're producing millions of them.
How much of it is social media, and how much it seems like you're saying a lot of it is, and how much of it is public policy decisions?
I don't think you can lay it at the feet of any one thing. Democrats want to blame it on social media. Republicans say it's mental health. We have the second most single parent homes in the world, just behind Sweden. And Dan Quayle was right that the outcomes are worse for single parent homes. Where he got it wrong is it doesn't matter if the two parents are same sex. But the moment, the single point of failure for a boy coming off the tracks and becoming more prone to a suicidal ideation, less likely to go to college, more likely to be incarcerated, is when he loses a male role model. And 1 in 3 men within 6 years of divorce have no contact with their children. And so when you look at, now let's just talk about the numbers in primary education. There are more female fighter pilots per capita than male kindergarten teachers. 70 to 80% of teachers through K through 12 are women.
Is that the case in other countries?
That's the correct question, Senator, and I don't know the answer. I don't know if it's, I know that increasingly in the U.S., more and more men are leaving the education sector. But where I was headed with this is you have millions of men who from the age of 0 to 25 have absolutely no men involved in their lives. And we don't like to admit it on the left or people on the left. I was told my buddy Jonathan Haidt said, stop saying we. But I think people on the left, and I consider myself a proud progressive, are afraid to even say that there's a difference in the genders, that boys need men. Now, what's interesting is that girls in single parent households have similar outcomes in terms of college attendance and income and self-harm. So what most of the research points to is that while physically stronger, boys are mentally and emotionally much weaker than girls. And we have just a group of young men who are much more susceptible to mental illness, self-harm. I mean, think about this, Senator Franken. If any other group was killing themselves at 4 times the rate of the control group, wouldn't we move in with social programs and more empathy? But here's the thing, because of the advantage you and I garnered, there's no empathy for these young men.
Well, talk about the advantages that we garnered. First of all, I'm a baby boomer. And you've talked about the wealth disparities between people on Social Security now and my generation and maybe your generation too. I'm not quite sure where you fit in on the way you calculate this. But the difference between people who are on Social Security, certainly, and people who aren't, there's a big disparity there.
Well, first off, let me say, Social Security has been an enormously successful program. The issue is, okay, when the average 70-year-old is 72% wealthier than they were 40 years ago, and the average person under the age of 40 is 24% less wealthy, and on an inflation-adjusted basis, people your age at 25 were making $85,000. People my age were making $65,000. And now 25-year-olds today are making $55,000. And you pair that with the fact that housing has doubled in cost and education has quadrupled.
And these are public policy prescriptions that have done this to some extent or to a great extent?
I think almost every major fiscal legislation over the last 20 or 30 years is nothing but an elegant transfer of wealth from young to old. We have a child tax credit that gets stripped out of the infrastructure bill because it costs $30 or $40 billion.
Which is crazy. It was shown that that did a tremendous amount for little children in impoverished families.
Reduced childhood poverty by 40% overnight. I didn't even think that was possible for $40 billion. But meanwhile, the $130 billion annual cost of living adjustment for Social Security flew right by. $1.4 trillion is transferred from people under the age of 65 to the wealthiest generation in history, people over the age of 65. I'm not suggesting anyone that needs Social Security should have it taken away, but Senator, neither you nor me should get Social Security. Otherwise, let's not call it a tax. Let's call it a pension. And why does the person working for me making $160,000 pay $9,000 a year in Social Security tax? And people such as myself who make substantially more than that also pay $9,000.
Pay $9,000 as well. Well, should we have a donut hole, some kind of thing where you pay more tax on your income after a certain point? Not at 160. 160 is where they cap it.
Just remove the cap. If it's going to be a tax, just remove the cap. And then what do you know? We'll start looking at it more. Once rich people start paying once Jeff Bezos starts paying 6% of his income on Social Security, we're going to start means testing it. Let's go to the two biggest tax deductions, mortgage interest and capital gains. Who makes their money from selling and buying assets?
Well, capital gains tax is absolutely ridiculous.
100%. But who does it benefit? It benefits me. The majority, 98% of my income comes from buying and selling assets and stocks. So I pay a lower tax rate than young people who make their money with sweat. When did we decide that the money that money makes is more noble than the money that sweat makes?
I disagree with you on raising it or that after 160, then you continue it because that would be unfair to, I'd go for a donut hole.
Say more. What do you mean by that?
A donut hole would mean that you pay till 160, mm-hmm. and then maybe you start paying a bit more at 400,000.
Well, how about just 4% for everybody? No cap. Lower taxes. And that's the dirty secret, Senator Franken, is if we tax the super rich and corporations and had an AMT where they all had to actually pay the... There's this giant misdirect. We have an argument over tax rates. It's not tax rates. It's the tax code. In the last 30 years, the tax code has gone from 400 pages to 4,000. And those 3,600 pages weren't to help the middle class. They were to fuck them. And it's essentially a series of loopholes that have created a tax system where the top 25 wealthiest Americans pay an average tax rate of 8% and corporations pay the lowest taxes they've paid since 1939. So the super earners, though, the other myth is that the rich don't pay taxes. Actually, the super earners, the workhorses, the mom's a baller lawyer. She's a partner at a law firm. Dad works his ass off and is an amazing accountant. They make $1.5 million a year between the two of them. They went to the elite schools, worked their asses off, super smart, super fortunate, making a ton of money. But it's all W-2 current income.
Sure. So they pay taxes on all their income as opposed
to... And they probably live in a city, in a blue state, and they're probably paying 48, 50, 52% tax. Mm-hmm. But if dad's chiropractic firm, if he figures out a way to start acquiring other chiropractic clinics and does a roll up with private equity, and then he sells them, I'll use myself as an example. I'm very transparent. I sold my last company. First $10 million were tax-free. Does that make any sense? And they say, well, Scott, you're productive. We want to encourage entrepreneurship. No entrepreneur.
Why were the first $10 million tax-free?
1202. Because
you invested in it or what?
1202 qualified small business. And that is if you start a company or you invest in a company with less than $50 million in assets, when it gets sold, if you've held the shares for longer than 5 years, the first $10 million or 10 times your original investment is tax-free. And so—
Really?
I invest $2.5 million.
I was not on the finance committee.
You were not on the finance committee. I invest $2.5 million in a company that does exceptionally well. And I want to be clear, I've lost a lot of money in companies. The first $25 million was tax-free. Every major tax loophole benefits the super rich, the super owners, and corporations.
Let's talk about public policy prescriptions. that you would make. Okay. For example, and I've going from a list of stuff you've proffered. Okay. Get rid of the capital gains tax we talked about.
Do what Reagan did. One tax rate. Doesn't matter how you make the income. It's all one rate or all one set of staggered rates. Alternative minimum tax. If you're either Amazon or you're Elon Musk and it ends up that you're paying no taxes because you take advantage of all these tax loopholes, nope, every corporation has to pay a minimum tax of 20%.
Where is Amazon located? Where are they officially?
I don't think they've done a double Dutch, but I'll give you an example. Apple is what they'll do is they have Apple International.
They're in Ireland.
That's right. And they license they give their IP to Apple International. And then Apple International leases the Apple brand to Apple America and charges them tens of billions of dollars to use the brand, thereby suppressing the income in a high tax domain, America, and increasing the revenues in a low tax domain, thereby substantially bringing down their tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on and on and on. On around these loopholes. And these loopholes benefit two groups of people, super owners and corporations. The reality is the bottom 50% of income earners pay very little federal income tax. They pay a lot in consumption taxes. They get especially hard in inflation. But the people who really get screwed in our tax code are the workhorses. They're kind of the super earners who don't own things. They make
those are the couple you talked about.
That's right. And so it's a perfect shield for any discussion around raising taxes on the wealthy. Because when Senator Sanders or Senator Warren talk about raising taxes on the rich and then start to characterize them as bad people, a lot of people who are powerful but not super rich go, what are you talking about? I'm paying 52% tax rate living here in Short Hills, New Jersey, working at Goldman Sachs. They're not the people we need.
That's why I want the donut hole.
There you go.
It's for those people.
But you could lower the tax rates if everyone paid them.
Mm-hmm.
You could actually reduce tax rates if it was no matter what, you made $12 million in gross income, you got to pay at least 20% on it. If you had AMT across corporations and the super owners, I believe you could actually reduce tax rates. So
are there ways to do that in the finance committee? Are there ways to...
You know that better than I do. You know the mechanics of how these things work better than I do. My sense is that Washington has been weaponized by very powerful special interest groups. You know this better than I do.
Yep. Okay. Let's try some other... increase minimum wage to $25.
Well, okay. So let me immediately go to the fears. Oh no, you're going to kill jobs and put tons of small businesses out of business.
But that hasn't happened in
California.
Cities where they've done
that. In California and Washington State, where they raised the minimum wage, it increased economic growth in the economy. Why? Because the wonderful thing about middle and lower income homes is when you give them money, they spend it all and it creates a multiplier effect. So it's actually stimulative of the economy. If minimum wage had just kept pace with productivity, it'd be at $23 a share. It's also another example of kind of screwing the young, because that's who minimum wage really, really impacts, is young people. And then they'll say, well, but McDonald's would be less profitable or Walmart would be. Yeah, you're right. They would be. And it would be worth it.
Okay. Other tax, the alternative minimum tax for corporations and high earners.
Yeah, and a multilateral tax treaty where these corporations would stop this double Dutch and reverse mergers into low tax domains. And we could enforce that. And
weren't we trying to do that?
And
do
we
a 15
did it.
Minimum?
15%. Yeah. I don't see why it wouldn't be 25. I don't understand. I mean, let me put it this way. As corporate profits have never been higher, as a percentage of GDP, wages have never been lower. So there's been a healthy tension between capital and wages, but capital's been kicking the crap out of labor for 30, 40 years now.
A negative income tax.
Look, my attitude is, and this might come in the form of a tax credit for children, but I think if you look at deaths of despair, obesity, diabetes, depression, incarceration, I think it would be less expensive to ensure that every household either gets income matched or outright grants for food stamps or healthcare up to, say, $50,000. My friend Andrew Yang called it UBI. He screwed up. It was terrible branding. He should have called it a negative income tax to get Republicans on board. So what I'm basically saying is every household with children should have a certain basic level of dignity. And there's different ways to get there, but I think you'd end up saving money in terms of social services.
Okay, here's one that I've been for a long time. It's free two-year college.
Our community colleges are kind of the unsung heroes in the United States. And if you look at the Cal State system in California, it's a decent role model for that. It's almost free. What I think we need is more targeted vocational programs, because if you look at the real economy, anyone renovating a house or anyone who's familiar with construction or our plans for building nuclear power plants or has tried to get an energy efficient heater installed knows there's a lot of good jobs available for people with basic skills. But what have we done? We've gotten rid of wood shop, metal shop, auto shop. You remember, Senator, those guys in high school that were just not going to go to college, but they could like fix your car and they could make shit with their hands. The economy is dying for those people.
How many, you know, young people now know how to repair a diesel engine?
I'm renovating a house, installing cabinetry well. You can make 80 or 100 grand a year if you know how to do that well. 11% of LinkedIn titles in Germany and the UK are the following title: apprentice. In the US, it's 3%. We need to stop shaming people who don't go to college and say there are great on-ramps into a great middle-class life with apprenticeships for vocational programming. And I think our Cal State system, which does a really good job, or our junior colleges, but our junior colleges are the unsung heroes of a U.S. education system.
Here's one that we've done. We finally started to do it, which is refund the IRS. Biden got that done. I think $60 billion more added to the budget.
I think it's important to have class traitors. FDR was a class traitor. Teddy Roosevelt got elected by a group of almost oligarchs running the railroads, and he turned around and said, I'm going to break you up. I'm a class traitor in the sense that I think you have to have wealthy people say, look, there's just certain taxes and things we should implement.
The IRS just announced that they have recouped $1 billion. It's gone just going after people who make over $1 million who hadn't been paying.
First off, you're absolutely right. For every $1 you give the IRS, they give you 12 back. And they're not harassing people. They're just enforcing the tax code. Because of that 4,000-page tax code now, in order to audit a wealthy person, you need a team of IRS representatives. And the team is no longer there. They're just underfunded. So what I can tell you is, someone who has a complicated tax return and makes really good money, the gestalt or the vibe or the incentives are the following: be as aggressive as possible, because it's unlikely you'll get audited. You know who AI audits now? The IRS is incorporating AI, but who does AI go after? Simple taxes.
That has to be the lowest income,
right? That's
right.
And the people on the far right are corporations, and wealthy people will say that it's harassment. All they're doing is enforcing the tax code. They're not harassing anybody. But $1 for every buck we give the IRS, they get 12 back.
As I said, they've just announced this $1 billion from successfully funding it. Okay, here's one that you say remove Section 230 protections.
So 230, basically, Ron Wyden, and I forget who the second Democratic senator was in 1997, said any of these platforms, or they call them nascent technology companies, is not liable for the content on their platforms, almost like it's a bulletin board. What I would argue is that if the content is algorithmically elevated, in other words, somebody has programmed an algorithm to take certain content and elevate it, that it should no longer enjoy 230 protection, because you're now an editor. You're now saying, I've made a conscious decision. Just an example, News Corp. They knew they were lying about Smartmatic voting machines. They knew it. And as a result, Smartmatic suffered financial harm, and they had to pay $750 million. I forget.
It was Dominion.
Yeah, but it was.
Smartmatic was not, it was actually not in any of the machines that were, they were saying.
Was that the software? But the bottom line is they spread misinformation that they knew was false, and it resulted in an economic harm to an organization. So the organization can sue them, and News Corp had to come up with $750 million. What happened on Fox was a dumpster fire compared to the nuclear mushroom cloud of misinformation that happened on Facebook. But because Facebook is, quote unquote, a nascent platform, it's totally immune from any scrutiny. So my belief is, okay, I'm a capitalist. I think these companies create actually are net positive, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't be regulated. So if you decide to elevate content because it enrages people or it just gets more clicks, then you are an editor and similar to any other media company should be held to the same standard. So remove 230 on algorithmically elevated content.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Scott Galloway. I want to ask you, because I know a little bit about your biography. My daughter is a huge fan of yours, and she asked me to ask this.
Okay.
You and I are both kind of born somewhere in the working class to middle class, somewhere in between, right? Or at least I was, I can tell you that. My dad didn't graduate high school.
Yep.
My mom didn't go to college. But I was a good student, and I got into Harvard. So, boom, if I want to have my future in anything but comedy, I had it made. Or if I wanted to go into finance or something like that. You go to UCLA, but you don't get in, right? You apply there and you don't get in because you were a bad student. Is that fair to say?
Mediocre. I was born to a single immigrant mother. Our household income was never more than $40,000 a year, and I was not an outstanding student. I had a 3.1 GPA at a high school, and I scored 1130 on the SAT.
So what were you doing
in high school?
Yeah, what were you doing in high school?
Not a lot, obviously. I wish I could say I was having a great time. I was just a really unremarkable kid. I was invisible. I wasn't that motivated. I was just not doing much of anything, playing sports a little bit, but I wasn't terrible. I wasn't getting into trouble or anything. I wasn't, you know, shoplifting or committing crimes, but I think I was like most American kids, Senator. I think I was just a decent kid. I was remarkably unremarkable, but here's the thing. America and California love me. Mm-hmm. One of the great public institutions had an admissions rate of 76%.
UCLA,
76%.
At the time.
And I didn't get in.
So what is it now? Do you know?
9.
Okay. Then we got to do something about that.
100%. I'm one of the 24% that didn't get in. And my dad got me a job installing shelving. And it was $18 an hour, which was a lot of money in the 80s. And so I used to get in my car, haul out to Ontario and the Inland Empire. And I was literally in a closet all day long installing shelving. And the highlight of my day was I'd get ridiculously high with my coworkers at the end of the workday and then turn to the highways of Southern California and go home. And I was living with my mom, and I remember coming home one day, and I just kind of broke down, and I got very emotional. I'm like, this is my life. I'm literally going to be in a closet. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of work, but I had been told my whole life that I was smart and creative, and I'm like, this is my life. And my mom said, well, is there anything we can do? And she found out that there was something called an appeal process, and I appealed. And I remember this moment. This guy from the admissions department called me and said, and the truth has a nice ring to it. I said, I'm the son of a single immigrant mother. I have to live at home. I don't have any money. If I don't go to UCLA, I'm going to be installing shelving the rest of my life. And I have plans to do more than that. Will you give me a shot? And I remember the day he called me, the admissions department guy called me and said, you're not qualified, but you're a native son of California, and we're going to let you in. And I rewarded the Regents of University of California with a 2.27 GPA, undergraduate GPA.
Congratulations.
Which isn't easy. The only thing I learned, Senator, in college was how to make bongs out of household items and every line from Planet of the Apes. And you know what happened after that? The greatest public institution in America, Berkeley, let me into graduate school. Imagine that, with a 2.27 GPA.
And how do you figure that you got in?
I interview well. I could write well. My application. My application was strong.
I interview well.
This is a flex. I'm desperate for your and your listeners' affirmation, but I feel like I need to add this. 3 months ago, I gave $14 million to UCLA and Berkeley. It's kind of worked out for all of us.
Did you just split it down the middle?
I'm investing in a vocational program. I think we need education to be more accessible and more affordable. And there's also a lot of great jobs out there for kids who don't necessarily need a traditional four-year liberal arts degree. And I think we can leverage the infrastructure of the University of California for kids to get degrees.
And I've heard you say that
There are so many people who are so intent on becoming a billionaire. And I've heard you say that you just, you don't want to be, that's not your goal, that you just give it away if you're getting close or getting anywhere near close.
Well, look, you're an ambitious guy and you're always looking for the next thing. And I sold my company, my last company in 2017, and I had big plans. I thought, okay, I have this much money. I've made my number. And I'm going to raise a private equity fund. I had a lot of contacts. I was kind of rounding third in terms of credibility. And I thought in my mind, I'd really like to be a billionaire. Scott Galloway billionaire sounded really interesting to me. And then I really sat down and I thought, what do I want from life? I'm an atheist. So the notion that at some point I'm going to look into my kids' eyes and know our relationship is coming to an end is very powerful and liberating for me. And I thought, how do I want to spend the rest of my life? Because it's going so fast. And I thought, I just want to be really happy. And I'm like, well, what makes me happy? And I'd written a book on happiness, and all the studies show too, it's deep and meaningful relationships, the number of them. And I thought, okay, I have all the money I need. I'm going to spend all of my money on experiences that make me feel closer to family and friends and are amazing. And then anything above that, I'm going to give away. And it makes me feel amazing. And it's the smartest decision I've ever made.
Could you write a book on that for other billionaires or for billionaires rather? Because if every person who was asked that same question of themselves, I think that we'd have a lot more, it would help the world.
Well, what it goes to, and I think you'll agree with this, is that Daniel Kahneman, who's one of my kind of economic role models or heroes, had this thing. Basically, he showed that people say money can't buy happiness. That's actually not true. Middle income people are happier than lower income. Upper income are happier than middle income. That's the bad news. The good news is that it tops out. So if the difference between having $30,000 and $50,000 makes you much happier, but the difference between $10 million and $20 million a year has no difference, then why wouldn't we go back to where we've been for most of our history in the U.S. with a tax rate that says, pick a big number, above 10 million, you're going to pay 70% marginal income tax rate. Because here's the thing, you're losing nothing. You're going to lose no happiness. Your kids aren't going to be any worse off. Dynastic wealth doesn't produce happy kids. Do you want a second jet? But meanwhile, we're going to take that money and make sure everyone's at least at 50.
What if you're a professional athlete?
Well, that's different because you only have a few years to make a lot of money.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's actually a real, I hadn't thought about that. So you just punctured my argument. You're sounding like a Republican.
I'm so sorry.
That's a really good point.
No, I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah.
Oh man.
70% of athletes end up bankrupt within 10 years of leaving the sport because they think they're going to make that living for the rest of their lives. But my point is I decided I have my number. I think most people have their number and I hit my number. And I thought, well, no, I want to go bigger. I want to be in front of my name. And then I thought, no, I'm going to do amazing things with friends and family. And anything above that, I track it every year. I'm going to give it away. And I can't tell you how happy it makes me.
Okay. I asked my daughter's question. I got my answer from that. Have you been at least looking at what Project 2025 has proposed?
Yeah, I saw season 5 of it last week. It's called The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it literally is The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, you're talking about people going to jail if they know someone who terminates a pregnancy. I mean, this is where we are.
They would be monitoring miscarriages.
I never imagined. I was lazy about this. I never imagined we'd be sitting here right now where 1 in 5 American women have to leave their state to terminate a pregnancy. And at some point, it'll never be 5 in 5 because this is what'll happen. It'll go to 3 in 5, maybe 4 in 5. But the 1 in 5 that are wealthy will have no problem terminating a pregnancy. I don't even see this as a war on women. I see it as a war on poor women. Because you can be sure that when a wealthy dude's daughter needs to terminate a pregnancy, he'll figure it out. They'll figure it out. This is not only a war on women, it's really a war on the poor is the way I would describe it. It's also something more insidious that's been a slow creeping erosion of the separation between church and state. Because what we've decided is that religion and legislation are no longer protected from each other. This is essentially a white Christian nationalist movement.
That's basically what this document is proposing. Okay, here are some of the things that it would do, 2025. Give Trump power to investigate his opponents, basically. Retribution. He's talked about retribution.
One of the things that separates us from an autocracy is it's generally accepted that we don't, our political leaders don't weaponize the assets of the government to go after their political enemies. That seems to be, again, falling by the wayside.
I would move the Justice Department and all of its law enforcement arms, like the FBI, directly under presidential control.
Same thing.
Yep. They'd get rid of the Education Department. So they would get rid of Head Start. And early childhood education has been shown to have tremendous return on investment.
Yeah, and I would have laughed this off a few years ago thinking it wasn't possible. And now I recognize that, no, take them at their word.
Do you want to hear more or you want
sure.
to just? Well, okay, well, here's one you'll love. / climate change protections.
Look, you have to admire the Republican Party that basically appeals to a small minority. The majority of America are not white Christian nationalists. The majority of America are not super rich corporations or the super wealthy. And yet they appeal to a large, they appeal to 47 or 49%. They've done a much better job marketing than we as Democrats have. They're much better at messaging and they're much more disciplined. I mean, Mexico, for God's sakes, just elected a woman who's Jewish, who was a climate scientist.
Yeah.
And we're talking about taking women back to old Spain. Around the world, you're seeing this ascent of women. Twice as many women have been elected to parliament in the last 30 years. You're seeing women's rights mostly expand in most Western nations. We're going backwards. So I find it very discouraging. And I actually think it might be the issue. It might be the issue that gets the Democratic nominee back into the White House. That really is our issue. I think it resonates with a lot of voters. Two-thirds of American voters believe that terminating a pregnancy should be, you know, accessible and legal.
I hear you. I think we'll end on that.
Senator, I told you this when I had you on my pod. I'm just an enormous fan of yours. And I think you're a great public servant.
And I have yours.
I appreciate
that.
So
thank you so much. This has been really great.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.